Ralph Stanley with his brother Carter on that, Ralph, on the Rank Strangers from their Old King Records. As we celebrate this weekend, on this Sunday, we celebrate the life of Ralph Stanley, who passed away this week from an extended illness that he had. First cut we had on Country Ramble tonight was Ralph, again, Ralph from his festival in 1975. One of his classic numbers, Nobody's Love Was Like Mine, Keith Whitley doing the lead singing on that. I've always loved Ralph Stanley's approach to what we call bluegrass music, and his type of music resonated so greatly here in the Miami Valley that I thought, even though I loved it, I thought I'd invite up tonight Fred Bartenstein, a expert who knew Ralph intimately. Fred Bartenstein, if you know, I'm sure you do, here on WYSO Radio, longtime programmer and contributor to this station. Fred's also a long time, has worn many hats in the bluegrass world as an entrepreneur, as a performer, as an author, as a historian, the author of several books now on bluegrass music. And he's, as I said before, has worked intimately with Ralph Stanley. Fred, thanks for coming up to the studios tonight on A Country Ramble here on WYSO Radio. I wanted to just start with a general question for you, Fred. How would you characterize Ralph Stanley's life? What was the significance, as we look back on Dr. Stanley's life from this perspective in the 21st century?
Two things that I think we should note. And first is that Ralph Stanley is the last of the pioneers. This is really an epical change in the bluegrass world as we've known it. Bill Monroe's original bluegrass boys are all gone. Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs are both gone. Carter Stanley has been gone, and now Ralph Stanley is the last of those original iconic figures. But what makes Ralph stand out from all of them and many, many other bluegrass musicians over the years, Tom, is that Ralph was the first bluegrass musician to decide to go backwards in time, to celebrate an earlier sound, going back even before recorded history, before radio, to go back to what Bill Monroe called the ancient tones. Ralph Stanley picked up a style of singing in the Pentecostal and Primitive Baptist churches of the coal fields of southwestern Virginia that sounded so eerie and so old. Bluegrass had been a modern thing. It had been kind of like rock and roll, a fast and exciting and young sound in the 1940s and 1950s. Today, it's easy for us to think of bluegrass being something old. And in part, that's because Ralph Stanley made it old. Ralph was just a teenager and sounded old, and brought a sound that generation after generation have come to think of as the echo of the past. In the soundtrack of our lives, if we wanted to hear something back to our great-grandparents' generation, Ralph Stanley was the voice that brought that to us.
And your contention is this is something different, something unique to Ralph that was not in, say, Bill Monroe's music, not even the way you're characterizing it, Fred, is that it was something different than the Stanley brothers actually did.
Right. Yeah, Ralph really did like, from the very beginning, the old sound. And this is before folk music became popular. Folk music had a lot of interest in traditional material and in old material, early recordings from the 20s. That's not what the world was like in the 40s and the 50s.
To get away from that.
Exactly. The 40s and 50s were all about tail fins and Sputnik and moving the Jetsons, moving into the future. So Ralph is an interesting character, and he has been a steadfast proponent of that from the very beginning. And I hope we get to play some of Ralph's early recordings when he was barely out of his teens, and then all the way through the rest of his life.
in many ways, I think what I hear you saying, Fred, is that he consciously chose to look backwards in time, perhaps in music. And I'm thinking, I do know his mother played the banjo, his mother played music, his dad was a singer. Is that where he looked back to, his family relationships as a growing up?
Ralph was a very taciturn guy. He held his cards close to the chest, and he started out quite shy. When he and Carter would play as children, they wouldn't even play in front of the guests. They would go in the kitchen and sing. Ralph told me one time in the shortest possible phrase, he said, "Well, I guess, Fred, that's just the way my voice was. When I sang, that's how it came out."
Even as a young man, he sounded as old as the hills.
Exactly. He said, that's the way it seemed natural to me to sing, to put the melismas in and to go back to the old lining out hymn sound that he had heard as a child. And that's the way it sounded, and that's the way he kept doing it.
What is melisma?
Melisma. Man. It's where you change notes. You actually work around a note.
Uh-huh. And that's very common in the country music vein, music world.
Well, it's common in the religious music.
Yes, it is.
In the unaccompanied, it's hard to do that with instruments. So you're going to hear it more in a cappella music, in churches that don't believe in instruments or churches that can't afford instruments. Churches where the people can't read, so the preacher has to line out the hymns. And it's absolutely the style of singing in the churches where people in the Miami Valley migrated from, in the coal fields of eastern Kentucky and southwestern Virginia and West Virginia.
And Fred, you said Ralph Stanley was a taciturn individual. You had the opportunity to interact with, I hope you don't mind if I just call him Ralph.
Sure.
In this day of modern technology, when we play their records so often, they seem so friendly and familiar to us, even though I never met the man, but you did. And you had the opportunity to work with him several times in many different capacities, I said at the beginning. You wrote articles, have written several articles, early profiles of Ralph Stanley, when he was just starting out on his own after his older brother's death, Carter Stanley.
Yeah, I was aware as a young teenager, barely in my teens, of the Stanley Brothers' music and had his records. I first encountered Ralph in 1965 at the first Bluegrass Festival in Fincastle, Virginia. That was the one and only time I ever saw his brother Carter.
Had a job in Florida.
They were living in Live Oak, Florida, and drove up to play that event. And I'm so glad that I found my way there. But then a few years later, I started working on bluegrass festivals and was editing a little bluegrass music magazine that was nationally distributed. And my family is from southwestern Virginia, so when I went home from college for Christmas, I called Ralph and his wife, Jimmy. Lisa Joy had just been born. Mm-hmm. That's Ralph II's older sister. And Ralph said that I was welcome to come down and visit. And so I brought a photographer and a tape recorder, and we did some of the earliest interviews with Ralph, and I published that in Mule Skinner News magazine in 1971.
In 1971. And you had done the recorded life of Ralph Stanley that you had done.
That was in 1969. I had narrated and emceed a show at Camp Springs, North Carolina, at the original Labor Day weekend Bluegrass Festival there. Telling the story of Ralph Stanley in narration and music. Larry Sparks was his lead singer, and Larry had laryngitis that weekend. And so when we told the story of Ralph Stanley, we had Red Allen and Charlie Waller and Cliff Waldron and Billy Edwards and Bob Morris and even I, we all took turns playing Carter Stanley's part in the Ralph Stanley story.
Yes.
And that was, I think that was how Ralph really got to know me, because I had to spend a lot of time with him. That was 1969 when I was 18.
And we have that recording with us tonight. Maybe we'll get that on. We will get some of that on before the evening's end. Fred, I have a recording in that you made with Ralph Stanley.
Yeah, this was from a concert in 1971 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at the Freshman Union at Harvard University, where I was a student. We brought Ralph Stanley and the Clinch Mountain Boys up there, and let's let Ralph introduce me on stage.
Let's hear it.
I had a lead singer to stand me up and give me about a 3 hours notice that he couldn't make the trip, so I was short coming up this way. And who was here to fill in but my old buddy Fred Bartenstein.
But there is one promise that is given. I'll meet you on God's golden shore.
Oh man, it sounds so wonderful. November 3rd, 1950, that was Ralph Stanley's first solo vocal on record, Man of Constant Sorrow. And of course, that's a worldwide hit today from the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? But that's where it came from.
And it continued to be a staple of his stage show, his presentation, Man of Constant Sorrow.
Yeah, yeah. It was an older song, but the way Ralph sang it didn't sound like anybody else. Ralph was an original from the beginning.
And it's interesting to think about 1950, the bluegrass world at that time, the Goins brothers were playing.
With the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers. No, they
yes.
hadn't. They hadn't
the
come
Lonesome
into
Pine
the
Lonesome Fiddlers.
Larry Richardson and Bobby Osborne were in the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers. The Goins brothers came in a year or two later.
Larry Richardson from Virginia, the Galax area of Virginia.
Right.
And I'm just trying to think about it. The Flat
what
and Scruggs
else was
were,
in bluegrass? Yeah.
Yes.
It was a small circle in 1950, and we have to remember that the word bluegrass had not been invented yet. The word bluegrass came around in the mid-1950s, and Ralph Stanley pretty much resisted being classified as bluegrass. He would say, I play the old mountain style. Some call it bluegrass. That was the way he would say
because
it.
Because he associated the term bluegrass
with
the music of Bill Monroe.
Right.
How will history judge that, Fred?
Oh, well, I think the word bluegrass has long been an umbrella term that means a whole lot of stuff. We needed a word to describe an increasing number of bands that were playing in that style. We should note, Tom, that Carter and Ralph Stanley were the second. Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys started in 1939, went on the Grand Ole Opry. 7 years later, the second bluegrass band arrives in 1946 as both Carter and Ralph come back from service in Europe. Carter had been in during the war. Ralph had been in the occupation forces in Germany. And when they came back, they started the Clinch Mountain Boys, the Stanley Brothers and the Clinch Mountain Boys in 1946.
And as you have pointed out, Fred, in other venues, they were modeling themselves after an old-time band that I enjoy very much, the Maynard's Mountaineers, J.E. and Wade Maynard.
Well, they were kind of equally influenced by Maynard's Mountaineers and Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys. Those were the two artists that they loved. And to a couple of boys from the country in Bristol, Virginia, singing a Bill Monroe song like Molly and Ten Brooks was intended to be tribute. It never occurred to them that Bill Monroe would take offense when the Stanley Brothers put Molly and Ten Brooks on the market before Bill could get his version of it out. So there was a little hard feelings there, but it dissipated quickly.
or when the Stanley Brothers got a contract with Columbia Records.
That was another tough moment.
For Monroe.
For Bill Monroe, yeah. Bill Monroe left the Columbia label because he was mad that the Stanley Brothers had been signed. He saw them as upstarts copying his music. But we'll have to hand it to Ralph Stanley's older brother, Carter, who salved that wound, particularly when Ralph decided to take a break from music. Carter joined Bill Monroe's Bluegrass Boys, and by deferring to Bill and being a sideman to Bill, Bill saw that Carter wasn't trying to take anything from him.
Carter,
and they were friends for the rest of their lives.
And Carter recorded some with Bill Monroe.
Yeah.
Some very classic.
Sugar-Coated Love.
Sugar-Coated Love, yes. And I was actually stunned, Fred, when I read one of your commentaries that Bill Monroe briefly considered changing the name of his band.
Isn't that an interesting sidelight of history? The early 50s were a tough time. Bill Monroe was not the star that he used to be. He had had some very big records with songs like Kentucky Waltz and Blue Moon of Kentucky. So Carter Stanley joined the band, and Ralph came over to play a show with Bill in North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken. And Bill Monroe asked Ralph if he would stay with him, and saying, because Ralph had always been the one that had held out, I will only play with the Stanley Brothers. He said, if you boys will come with me, we'll change the billing to Bill Monroe and the Stanley Brothers.
I am truly speechless with that.
And Ralph said, no, I don't want to do it. So Ralph got back in the car with his friend Pee Wee Lambert that had driven over with him, and they drove home. And on the way back to Virginia, they were in a very bad wreck. And so
Ralph had to take some time off.
Ralph took some time off from music, but he was able during that time to convince Carter to come back and decided that being a veterinarian was going to be his role in life.
And so when Ralph had come back from the military, his initial attention was not even to play music, but to go to veterinarian school.
Yeah. And in fact, the military had noticed that Ralph was an extremely bright young man. They thought he had a future as a career military. And they tried to get him to stay in and become a lifer.
But he moved to this rather insecure business of playing what we now call bluegrass music.
Once again, with Ralph has kind of a chipmunk grin. And he would, when he would tell me these stories, he would say that being a musician was a whole lot better option than being a coal miner. And that being a coal miner was about all he could see that would make any sense for him economically, because the hillsides are so steep and the ground is so rocky in Dickinson County, Virginia, that farming is not a viable career choice.
Yes.
And the timber had been pretty much cut out by then. Their father had worked at a sawmill, but the timber was gone. The mines were the only thing going on, and that's why music looked like a good plan.
Fred, I'd like to tie some threads together. You sang what we heard for you sing the lead song, "Little Glass of Wine." That was from the era of the Carter of the Stanley Brothers that we're referring to.
That
right
was
now.
Their first hit. "Little Glass of Wine" was a song that their father Lee had actually brought to them. They rearranged it, rewrote it, and they recorded "Little Glass of Wine" three different times.
And
twice for Richard Tone and once for Columbia, and it was their hit. That was their signature song, "Little Glass of Wine."
You usually refer to that as a regional hit. What would you mean by that? Regional in what area?
Well, their radio station was in Bristol. And one of the interesting things about Bristol is that there's a main street is the state line between
yes,
Tennessee and Virginia. And so when you're on the radio in Bristol, you are covering East Tennessee, southwestern Virginia, northwestern North Carolina, and southeastern West Virginia. So that is the Appalachian region that interestingly today, Tom, is probably the number one hot place for bluegrass
still
in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Asheville and mm-hmm. Johnson City and
yes.
Bristol are hot places mm-hmm. for music today, and they were back then.
And when Ralph got out of the military, went to work with his brother in a band locally on radio there, Ralph was playing not the Scruggs style, bluegrass style banjo.
Earl Scruggs was the no, you're right.
Yes. So
you had said earlier mm-hmm. that the Stanley Brothers followed Bill Monroe and Wade Maynor mm-hmm. and Zeke
yes.
Morris or Maynor's Mountaineers,
yes.
and Wade Maynor played in the two finger style. And that's how Ralph played starting out. He also played, and maybe you'll later on demonstrate to people something like Shout Little Luly or
yes,
one of the clawhammer
mm-hmm.
sounds that Ralph could play so well. But he started out playing with two fingers. And when Lester Flatt, Earl Scruggs, and the Foggy Mountain Boys broke off from Bill Monroe in 1948, I realize this is getting a little geeky here, but 1948, 2 years after the Stanley Brothers starts, here's the third band in bluegrass, Lester Flatt, Earl Scruggs, and the Foggy Mountain Boys. They come to Bristol, where both Flatt and Scruggs and the Stanley Brothers are appearing at the same time. And that's where Ralph learns the three-finger style that is associated with Earl Scruggs.
And just to tie this thread as well, Man of Constant Sorrow, as you indicated, that was for Columbia Records in 1950.
Right.
But it would shoot to international fame in what year?
In 2000.
2000.
The Soggy Bottom Boys.
Yes, who sang that? Ralph didn't sing that.
No, that was sung. Let's see if we can name all three of them. Dan Tominski and Harley Allen. And the third one is from the Nashville Bluegrass Band.
Oh, yes. Pat Enright. Yes.
So those were the three singers that
sang. But it was consciously made after the Stanley Brothers sound.
Totally. And Ralph also sang in the soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? In what I always considered a questionable judgment, Ralph allowed his voice to be used behind a robed Ku Klux Klan
yes.
figure
yes.
singing Oh Death.
And in the, you are right, in the movie, questionable is the correct designation to make. But what struck me was that song, the presentation of Oh Death, had a life of its own separate from that particular scene, both on the subsequent album, the soundtrack album that came out, and on stage shows after that. Oh, Death became separate from that visual association.
It became Ralph's new signature song. It became the song that Ralph had to close every concert with. It became the song that was nominated for a Grammy. He beat all the major stars in country music that year and won the Male Vocalist of the Year, largely on the strength of Oh Death, if you don't think reality isn't strange.
And Oh Death, this presentation, we'll hear it in just a second. This harks back to that old mountain sound that you had started the show out referring to.
Yeah. The Doc Boggs was a neighbor of the Stanley Brothers from down in that coal fields area. Doc Boggs would have been a figure that the Stanley Brothers would have heard in their youth, probably live, certainly on the Victrola records. And Doc Boggs had a version of Oh Death. And T-Bone Burnett suggested that Ralph Stanley sing that in the soundtrack. But Ralph said, no, I don't want to have any instruments on it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make it really lonesome.
Oh,
I'm going to sing this as
an
acapella solo.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to shiver the audience when
yeah,
they hear
did.
It.
Let's shiver.
Fred. Let's do.
Okay.
Oh, death. Oh, death. Won't you spare me over till another year?
Bright morning stars are rising. Day is a-breaking in my soul.
Ralph Stanley and the Clinch Mountain Boys. We're celebrating Ralph Stanley's life this week on A Country Ramble here on WYSO Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Ralph passed away this last week. Ralph Stanley, the one of the signature original artists in the bluegrass world, the bluegrass fame. And we invited up to the studio this week Fred Bartenstein from Yellow Springs, Ohio. Fred is a longtime entrepreneur, author, historian, a performer in the bluegrass style, and knew Ralph Stanley intimately, worked with him many times. Fred, you were telling me that that a cappella style that we just heard, Bright Morning Star, was something new in bluegrass at the time.
Yeah, it was. Bluegrass music, remember we had said a few minutes ago that bluegrass music was a modern sound and it was a band sound and the banjo was the hot rod instrument. So it was a new idea that Ralph Stanley brought in 1971 with that particular band. And in fact, that very cut was the first a cappella recording in the history of bluegrass music. I think I can safely say that. There have been a number since then. But
in
the
fact,
idea.
It's a frequent choice now of bands to present their music in that style, most often in a gospel presentation.
That's right. And so Ralph brought that in. He had these great singers with him. He had Roy Lee Centers and Jack Cook. And let's see, in that quartet, probably Keith Whitley was the fourth part. And this was an old song. And Ralph had Ralph and Carter had played the folk clubs. In the early 1960s, they'd played the Newport Folk Festival, and Ralph had figured out that the older the music, the older the style, the more the folk audience liked it. And so he thought he would try something new, also to be different than every other bluegrass band. And after Ralph's performance of Bright Morning Star in 1971, I don't think he ever did a concert that he didn't have an a cappella song. And then right behind him were the Country Gentlemen and the Bluegrass Cardinals, who were.
And this strikes me, Fred, as a risky move in a sense, economically in the bluegrass world.
Because see, we were defining bluegrass as the sound of the banjo.
As a culture, yes, we were. This was the time of Bonnie and Clyde on the.
So imagine, I mean, if bluegrass was defined by the instruments, what if you took all the instruments out? That it was a risky move.
And I'm also thinking Bright Morning Star is just, it's spine-chilling. However, it would never sell millions of records on the country market.
Oh,
and,
no.
And I'm reminded that the Stanley Brothers themselves, their only chart-placing song, their chart-placing record was a novelty number called How Far to Little Rock.
Right.
And if Ralph wanted to reproduce that success, as perhaps minor as it was, at least it was charted, it was on the charts, he wasn't going to do that by recording Bright Morning Star.
Well, you know, when the Stanley Brothers started out, there was no such thing as the word bluegrass. They were all part of country music, or the term that was used at the time, hillbilly music. And Carter Stanley always imagined that they might be able to have a country hit. And the Stanley Brothers records did appear on jukeboxes, and they mm-hmm. were played on mm-hmm. DJ shows, only in the South and where Southern migrants went. Mm-hmm. The sound of the Stanley Brothers was never particularly appealing to the modern audience that would like Jim Reeves and Patsy Cline.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You're saying, in a sense, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Fred, but Ralph somehow realized that. He had
Ralph
a vision
knew.
Of
he,
his music.
He knew that he was not going to be a country singer. He mm-hmm. knew he was not going to compete with Merle Haggard and Porter Wagoner. Mm-hmm. And he came along with the Clinch Mountain Boys at a time that the bluegrass world was beginning to develop its own set of fans, and it was becoming a separate genre. It was the stepchild of country music, and it was the remnant of folk music as the folk music wave receded. And so the bluegrass world was beginning to build at the time that Ralph recorded Bright Morning Star. And he recorded it on a label that was 98% bluegrass, the Rebel label.
Right, yes.
And they sold it at concerts, and there was a brand new bluegrass magazine or two, and there were bluegrass festivals that were new. So,
as I recall, the name of that album was Something Old, Something New. That was the title of that album.
There were two albums that came out
at the same time.
And one of them was Something Old, Something New that was all secular. And then Bright Morning Star was on the companion album.
Okay.
Cry from the Cross, if I'm not mistaken,
really?
Was the name of that album.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I think is interesting, particularly in light of Ralph's recent passing, is that Ralph's theology, the church that Ralph grew up in, is unique in that they don't believe in hell. They believe that if there is hell, it's here on earth, and that the promised land, the bright morning star day is shining in my soul, that's where we're going to be okay. That we're not, after we die, we're not going to be tormented forever. The torment is here.
I like this, Fred.
So Ralph is, and if you listen to his gospel music, it all talks about a better place. If we can just put up with what we're going through now, we're going to go to a better place.
And if we draw back, take a long view of this, Fred, what we're skirting around is the relationship between an artist and his or her audience. I wanted to move to a series of recordings that were made here in Yellow Springs, Ohio, in 1960. The Stanley Brothers played here at Antioch College, Kelly Hall, which is just across the street from where we're broadcasting right now. Tell us about, this is an interesting development in bluegrass music, isn't it?
There are two waves that converge in Yellow Springs, Ohio in 1960. One of them is this giant phenomenon of migration from the upland south to the northern industrial cities. And Dayton is one of the great recipient communities of folks from Ralph Stanley's kind of people, from Ralph Stanley's kind of territory.
From his hometown, yes.
People
or
who knew
area.
The Stanley Brothers. And
in
a way to hold on to their childhood and their roots and their connection is to patronize Ralph Stanley and the Stanley Brothers when they come to Dayton. So Ralph plays Dayton all the time. He's probably got more fans here than in anywhere in the world in 1960. The second wave that's breaking is the folk music boom. And Antioch is ahead of the curve in that they've got a folk music club, and they're booking the first bluegrass concerts in colleges in history. In March of 1960, the first one. A couple months later, the Stanley Brothers are the second one.
And the first one was a local Dayton.
The first one was the Osborne Brothers from Dayton.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think the people who booked Ralph Stanley and Carter, this is the Stanley Brothers, were they aware of the Appalachian roots of much of the Miami Valley?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Alice Gerard, Alice Foster at the time, had been an Antioch student, and they were very aware of the Appalachian, because Alice had, with her friends like Hazel Dickens and Mike Seeger, they'd done co-ops in Baltimore and Washington, and they had seen the Appalachian migrant scene in Baltimore and Washington, which are people from east of the Blue Ridge that migrate that way. Here are folks from west of the Blue Ridge. And so, that was one of their hopes, is that the concert would appeal both to the students and to the community.
And as the Stanley Brothers appeared here in Yellow Springs in 1960, we're going to hear much of this concert. Did they alter their performance or their stage show to meet the needs of that audience? Is this an accurate representation of their stage show at the time?
Yeah, I think it was. Now, we have to remember that Carter Stanley was one of the first bluegrass musicians. Earl Scruggs and the Stanley Brothers were both on the Newport Folk Festival in 1959. So we're a year after that.
Mm-hmm.
Carter was an early adapter of the, seeing the folk audience as being a positive thing. In fact, Carter, interesting footnote, Carter had to drag Bill Monroe into the notion that that the folk music world would be good for him.
Carter could see that.
Carter knew it because he played. He said, "Those are just people like you and me. They might look a little scruffy, but but they're good people, and they like our music, and they really like the older stuff." And, but as I look at the songs that they're singing, yeah, those were songs that that was not specific to a folk music audience.
They start out with one of Ralph's and the Stanley Brothers' signature tunes, "How Mountain Girls Can Love That." And Ralph comes in just gangbusters on the banjo on this. They recorded this originally for King Records,
right,
in Cincinnati,
right,
so,
2 years earlier.
And so here, let's take a trip. Take a trip back 1960, just a few hundred feet away from where we are right now, Fred Bartenstein and I. And let's hear the Stanley Brothers at Kelly Hall in at Antioch College, 1960, in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Get in, boy, go back home, back to the girl you